Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and it is cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Studio, sweet studio. I'm back. Made it back from northwest Wisconsin. And, it seems with almost every trip, have I got a tale to tell? It's not a tale, it's a matter of fact. But as is almost always the case when I head off out and away from the hills and hollers of almost level West by God, Virginia. There's a lot to be learned for me. And hopefully to share with you. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. Your home for a little progressive exercise that we like to call conversation radio. If you want to listen, there are a variety of platforms, starting, of course, with headonradionetwork.com. Click Listen Live, and you're right there. But you can also listen live on Roku devices, at TuneIn Radio, with the Tuner Internet Radio on your app on your phone, with Stitcher Internet Radio, Dar.fm, Streama.com. We are just all over the place. If you want to catch the podcast address is at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program. And you can also get the podcast at iTunes. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It is the 10th day of December 2012. This tired, worn-out little trip around the sun. This particular revolution of the Earth around the sun, as opposed to the sun around the Earth, which we only figured out after a few heretic burnings and things like that by Holy Mother Church, isn't the case. Burn some sense into them, I say! Now, this year is almost done. But we will keep plugging away all the way toward the end. Let's see, program notes. I'm probably out of here. There will be no Friday on the Front Porch Show because I'm heading down to Knoxville, Tennessee. I'm heading down to Knoxville to do some talking about the AIC Act and the health crisis here in Appalachia. And that will take, and then I'll be back on Saturday. So, sorry, but I would not leave if I did not think the work worthwhile. And that's always the case. The Horn, by the way, is listener supported. It has continued for almost 8 years now in this present incarnation because of your determination to see it continue. That's how we pay all the bills that go with trying to keep this thing going. If you look over at headonradionetwork.com, you'll see the little bar graph that keeps up with progress, and it is still tied to the $2,500 a month benchmark. You'll see that we are roughly 20% funded for the month. We are, however, more than 20% of the way through the month. We look to raise about $150 a night, So hopefully that will happen this evening. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. The snail mail address is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, personal mailbox, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. That's Beckley, West Virginia, WV, 25801. Checks, money orders, things like that, please do not make them payable to Bob Kincaid, as Bob Kincaid does not receive them. Make it payable to Head On Communications, The Horn, something like that, Head On Radio, like that. And all will be well. So hopefully we'll raise at least $150 this evening. More if we want to catch up and come good on the, you know, being where we are. But anyway, whatever happens is very definitely a help. It is, like I said, truly wonderful to be back home again. Now, I told you I was going up to Northwest Wisconsin, and it truly is Northwest Wisconsin, Bayfield County and Ashland County and Iron County up there on the shores of Lake Superior. Because they are under assault there. As I told you before, a guy who cut his teeth ruining communities for coal has set his sights on some absolutely magnificent, stunning geography in Northwest Wisconsin. There, right by the shores of Lake Superior. And wants to do to that lovely area much of what he has done to places like Southern Illinois and West Virginia and points otherwise in obtaining wealth. The locus of his target is a geologic formation called the Pinoki Hills, in what is known as the Gogebic Range. Those hills contain, among other things, a low-grade iron ore called taconite, which is what they're after. And they want to use mountaintop removal techniques to get at this iron ore. If you go back, go to Google Earth or something and look for Ashland, Wisconsin, and then sort of go east and south just a little bit, you'll see the Pinoki Hills. And you will see that there are rivers there and streams. And we're talking about pristine streams. I mean, crystal clear streams. Beautiful streams. Gorgeous streams. Streams like the Tyler Fork and the Bad River, which is a very good river indeed. And all of it is slated for destruction by this mining company. GTEC, it's called, for short. GTEC. Much of the land where the tailings, the waste, the toxic waste, the poison, would be dumped, ultimately drains into the Bad River, which then flows through lands that are sovereignly held by the Bad River Band of the Anishinaabe people, also known as the Ojibwe. And they are decidedly against the destruction of that land. So I left on Tuesday. Let's see, left Charleston, 71 degrees Fahrenheit, in December, flew to Atlanta where it was 85, finally got into some at least cool weather at Minneapolis-St. Paul where it was about 35, and eventually landed with a whole bunch of ice on our wings. That was real fun. I guess it just can't be helped sometimes. Landed at Duluth, Minnesota, where I was picked up by my hosts, Bill and Pete, and driven about an hour and a half down to Ashland. Even the drive down late at night, because it was late by the time I landed, it was 9:30 or so, even the drive down was magnificent, because it just so happened that moonrise came along as we were going down toward Ashland. And how beautiful it was. I'm used to horizons that are bounded by hills, or what is left of them. I'm not used to a flat horizon where the sky simply meets the land at some unknown point in the far distance. But there's a lot of flat up that way. But just because it's flat doesn't mean it's not special. Especially when it gives you visions like what I had. Because as we drove from Duluth down toward Ashland, the moon rose. And it wasn't quite pumpkin orange, and it wasn't quite crookneck squash yellow, but somewhere in the middle. And when it first came up over the horizon, it looked to be about the size of a basketball. And it sort of backlit the trees on the horizon. And it looked, it was like nothing I'd ever seen before. I mean, we've seen big moonrises and stuff here, but not like this. Not such that you could almost reach your arm out level with your shoulder and take it in hand. It seemed very much a part of that part of the world. And as we headed south and east toward Ashland, in a Prius, I might add, that was getting awesome gas mileage and was inspiring in that right all by itself, and my hosts were telling me basically everything that was going on and the background to the struggle. Things like Wisconsin opening up a season for the nighttime hunting of wolves. Something about wolf hunting doesn't sit right with me. And that's not because I get all squishy over hunting. Anybody who's ever had a garden taken down to nothing by a deer has no compunction against hunting. It's just payback. It's part of the cycle of things, you see. But wolf hunting and the history of the determined struggle of the Bad River Band of the Ojibwe to protect and preserve their rights and their history, their heritage, and their absolute way of life. They've battled these battles before, you see. Some years back, another group of parasitic extraction industry executives who, of course, you know, they're not really extracting mineral resources, they're extracting wealth. There was a plan for a mine in Michigan, but they needed to transport sulfuric acid in train cars to the mine. And the plan was to take the sulfuric acid in train cars across old, old railroad tracks that crossed the Bad River Reservation. And the determined people of the Bad River Band sat down on the railroad tracks and said no. And eventually the mine was the one that broke camp and left. So they understood that they understood then, and they understand now that everything that is sacred, and I do mean sacred, this program is not particularly attuned to the sacred, but I have no problem with this whatsoever. Because what I saw manifested was an understanding that the people and the land are one. And as a friend of mine pointed out, some people talk about that elsewhere. Some people talk about that here in Appalachia. But I have never felt it to be absolutely integrated, if you will. But that is the case here. So we got in. I stayed at the lodge and casino on the Bad River Reservation, and that in itself had a certain special quality to it. Because, as I've told you before, one of my multi-great-grandfathers was the first so-called first white settler on the Meta River here. That means he came in and stole himself some land. Legend has it that he plowed with the traces in his teeth, one hand on the plow and one hand on a musket, and that his wife sat on the porch doing her sewing work with another musket across her lap. Because they were prepared to kill native people to hold on to the land that they'd stolen. And he stole a bunch of it. It's not like he stole a little patch of ground and put a cabin on it. He walked the entirety of the Meadow River up to where it meets the Gauley and blazed trees with his hatchet and said, "I claim this land in the name of me." And then spent his golden years parsing out acreage to his grandsons and granddaughters as they got married. And so some portion of my ancestry is that. And so it felt a little bit like a loop was closing when I went to sleep early on Wednesday morning, there on the tribal lands of the Bad River people. It felt very, very good. Got up the next day, had speaking engagements at Northland College there in Ashland, Wisconsin. Met wonderful students at that. Northland College is a little liberal arts college that still does the whole liberal arts thing. But here's the really cool part that'll speak to those of you with an environmental mindset. Every course they teach at Northland College must, by virtue of their mission statement and commitments, must have a component of environmentalism. Every course topic is examined with at least some view toward the tie-in with this planet upon which we live, which seems fitting to me, because no planet, no literature, no planet, no astronomy, no planet, no geology, no planet, no education, and on that way. So I got to speak to them, got to speak some classes there, got to talk to the Student Environmental Council, got to do a radio interview, did a couple of radio interviews. And that evening, that Wednesday evening, I was to deliver an address out back at the lodge. But before that, with the sun fading from the sky, we went down to the shores of Lake Superior. we were going to visit another fellow that my hosts had hoped to introduce me to. I did meet him later. But I got to feel the wind whipping in my face from off of Lake Superior and look out at that vast body of water. Somewhere between 10 and 20% of the entire freshwater supply of the world is in what we call the Great Lakes. You know, for a redneck boy like me, lake is something that happens when, like, the TVA gets formed and dams up the Tennessee River. What I saw was no lake. What I saw was a sea. And not like any little pissant sea like the Sea of Galilee. This was a sea. Hundreds of feet deep in places. Maybe even 1,000. I wonder what the number of people is whose only real working reference for the Great Lakes, and particularly from Lake Superior, is that Gordon Lightfoot song. I had it stuck in my head. It was earwormed to me for about the first 3 days. The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down to the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Superior, it said, never gives up its dead when the gales of November turn gloomy. Yeah, you get the idea. It's beautiful. The waters seem to change color throughout the day. Even this late in the year, there were still waterfowl on it. I saw swans in the wild for the first time. Canada geese I'm used to. I looked around. Dadgum, there's swans! And there were. Hey, Waggy, it's only fair. I had that stuck in my head for a week. Everybody else... All we got in common is our misery, and the least we can do is share it, so enjoy it. Maybe I'll play it and get it out of your head here in a little bit. No, I won't play it. But, of course, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, was a masterpiece of iron ore freighter technology. There's that line, with a load of iron ore 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and crew was a bone to be chewed when the yada, yada, yada. And the iron ore business is still a going concern in that part of the world. But keeping it from expanding into a place as beautiful, as profound, as arguably pristine as anywhere there is a noble and a worthy struggle. Lake Superior was just about fished to death, but the fish are returning to a certain extent. They're not back where they need to be. There still needs to be much good faith stewardship. Went to the local visitors center and learned a little bit about the aquatic life of the region. The lake trout, the whitefish. In the streams, the muskie. The brown trout. The native brook trout. That whole area teems with life. There are otters. I love otters. There are porcupines. There are wolves. So I saw the shore of the lake. And then we went to a potluck dinner there on the reservation. And I was introduced to some more of the folks who are deeply involved in the struggle to save that land and the people from the predatory conduct of the parasitic practitioners of extractive industry. Before that meal began, there was a spirit offering for the ancestors. Just a little plate with a little bit of the food to be had that night, offered up in remembrance of the ones who are gone but still present. And it was very real, and it was very much a part of the reality of the moment. And as the guest, after that took place, I was asked to go first and fill my plate. I was thrilled to see that there was a big pot of the wild rice that is harvested every year by the Anishinaabe people of the Bad River Reservation. It's delicious. As was the rest of the meal. We talked a lot about what happens when extractive industry comes to your neighborhood. We talked about what happens when massive ammonium nitrate and fuel oil explosions take place. As an aside, I'll note that our good friend Eugene Finnerman over at FinnermanWorks.com, FinnermanWorks.com, recently commemorated the awarding of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry to the man, the German man, the German Jewish man, who invented the nitrates or discovered the nitrates that he ostensibly said would be really good for the soil, but also happened to make a really good boom. He also went on to invent the poison gases that would be used on the fields of France during the First World War, and eventually invented Zyklon B. That would be used in other applications in the next World War. How about that? The guy that gave us the explosives that are used to the tune of 5.5 million pounds per day in Appalachia to blow up our mountains is also the same guy who discovered or invented the gas that was used at places with names like Dachau, Bergen-Belsen, Auschwitz. How about that? The guy who invented the explosives that rained death and destruction from giant Krupp's artillery pieces in the First World War made possible the massive explosions whose byproduct is birth defects, heart disease, cancer, environmental degradation, and all the other horrors that go with extractive industry. We talked about all of these things. Thursday came, and there was another class to talk to, a geology class, which I enjoyed immensely simply because way back when I was writing my dinosaur to college, I chose geology for my sciences instead of biology or chemistry or something like that. And so it was nice to be back in a geology classroom talking about strata and layers and epochs and eons and Titanic plates. But we talked about how there is nothing you can do to the earth that the earth will not eventually tattle on you for. We talked about things like plow scars that can still be seen thousands of years after they were made. Just from a plow. We talked about that in conjunction with the Ojibwe tradition of not digging into Mother Earth. And they mean it when they say Mother Earth. That's why they don't that's why they had the tradition of not burying their dead or exposing them to the elements as some of the Plains tribes did. They built mounds over their dead instead of burying them in the ground. Which kind of makes sense because you wouldn't necessarily want to put death into life itself, would you? And then that evening, there was a panel discussion at Northland College. I sat on the panel, as did a truly inspiring young woman named Jessica Kosky and the Bad River Band tribal chairman, Mike Wiggins. As a descendant of white Europeans of indeterminate tradition, it was inspiring to see that room cleansed with the smoldering sage smoke to purify the room before we got started. Inspiring indeed. And we talked about the fact that when something like a active industry comes to your town, whether that your town be in Wisconsin or West Virginia, Virginia, Tennessee, Eastern Kentucky, Minnesota, whether your town be Nevada, in Nevada or anywhere else on this continent, when extractive industry comes, you only get one chance to get it right. One chance. And the only way to get it right is to tell them no and make them leave. Because if they get started, they will not stop until they have determined to have reached a stopping place. No other thing will stop them. The EPA won't stop them. The Clean Water Act won't stop them. The Clean Air Act won't stop them. Nothing will stop these parasites until they have sucked the host dry. And that's the reality. There's only one way to get it right, and that's to tell them no. Because they say things like, and it's been said up there, in that beautiful, beautiful land, we can protect the environment and mine responsibly. The problem is, well, it's an adverb problem, isn't it? Because they say mine responsibly, but at the same time, they insist on being the ones who determine what responsibly means. And frankly, in corporate speak, responsibly means to our greatest financial benefit. I mean, consider the realities of that geography, that topography. It's a line of hills called the Pinocchio Hills. They're beautiful. They go up to about 1,300 feet in elevation at the ridge crest. And they don't really have any valley. You know, here, mountaintop removal, they simply fill up the valley next to the mountain, kill everything that lives, breathes, walks, crawls, swims, flies, slithers, whatever. They bury the valley and the streams next to it with the stuff that comes off the top of the mountain. But they don't have anywhere to do that. So they just plan to dump everything in the watershed. Yeah, let me say that twice. They plan to dump everything else in the watershed. Because you see, geologically, all that land that is northwest Wisconsin there is actually part of the seabed of back when Lake Superior was a heck of a lot bigger and went a lot further. And so there are places that are still sort of marshy. The technical term for it is wetland. And they're just going to dump this stuff in those wetlands and claim that they're being responsible by doing it. Can't be done. God. So we had the panel discussion, and it was... well, it was inspiring to me. Because I'm used to these, at least here in Appalachia, I'm used to a bunch of people showing up in their dirty mine clothes saying, "What about my job? I got some food on my family. I get to have a job even if you got to die for me to have one, because I gotta buy a new tanning bed bulb for my wife woman every year." That wasn't there. Everyone in that room on both evenings seemed absolutely committed to stopping this atrocity before it can get started. Because that was another part of the consideration. No business model can exist side by side with extractive industry, whether they're extracting taconite iron ore or coal or unicorn pixie dust. The extractive model imposes a sort of colonialism on any community where it's practiced. And if you're not playing ball with them, you're not playing ball. And they're already telling the same lies up there in Wisconsin that they've told down here. Well, we'll bring, you know, it started off, we're probably at 70 jobs, you know, 35 of them will be people that we bring in, and then we'll hopefully train 35 people up from around here. They'll earn between 48 and 60,000. And then it starts mushrooming. Oh, there's going to be 700 jobs, and they're going to be $60,000 a year. Oh, there's going to be 7,000, $100,000 a year jobs. And the numbers go up as they see the need to try to convince more people, because there is economic desperation up there, as there is almost anywhere that there are natural resources in the ground. Because, see, they have a mining tradition up there of deep shaft iron ore mining from 100 years ago. I'd like to go up there and have a month or two to spend just studying that old 100-year-old culture and comparing it with the 100-year-old culture here. Because just as with West Virginia, so too the mighty forests of the northern upper Midwest Great Lakes area was completely wiped out. There is no old growth forest left there. There's none left here. It is also interesting that it all begins shortly after the Civil War, roughly, in both places. It is the ramping up of the Industrial Revolution. It is the priming of the pump of the American century. The 20th century was literally built on the backs of people worked to death and environments worked to death. Hurley, Wisconsin, is a case in point. Over next door to Ashland County and Iron County. Iron County, get it? And a lot of those people have looked up and said, "What? We're going to have..." Well, I got the wrong accent. "What? We're going to have some jobs? Oh, we like jobs." My host tried to set up some speaking engagements over in Iron County, and not even the churches would provide a forum for discussing the toxicity of the mining industry. What does that tell you? So then, after talking about all this, on Friday, a number of us got in one of the Ashland College, Northland College vans, and went to see it. It wasn't bitterly cold. It was cold, but it was more than possible to get around. And first, we drove down one highway to a scenic overlook within a national forest area. Yeah, go figure. Same as here. They blow up mountains within a couple of miles of a national park. They're planning on blowing up the Pinoki Hills in a couple of miles of a national forest. Go figure. But we got the long view of the Pinoki Hills. Got back in the van, went driving again, and we stopped and met. Wisconsin is justifiably known for its agriculture. And we went to a beef farm. They do beef and dairy. They got 1,000 acres or so. And they raise beef for slaughter, and they raise beef for dairy. And they welcomed us into their home because you can sit in the dining room of their home, and it's a home that's been there for 4 or 5 generations since great-great-great-grandpa came over from Italy. And looking out that dining room window, you can see the Pinoki Hills less than a half a mile away. And this family understands that they and their cattle and everything that has been built over the generations is done. Finished. Kaput. The minute the first blast goes off, because they'll be covered in dust, the dust will settle into the water. The dust will land on the soil. The cattle will literally eat the toxic waste dust of these explosions. They welcomed us into our home, and they were wonderful, friendly, friendly people. But they were determined all the way to the core of their being to stop this before it can get started. They told stories about how during the Depression, their family had kept the other families fed in the community so that there could be some meat on the table. And not even hey, how much money do you have? No, just here, take this, go, feed your family. And in due time, when you can do some good back. And it was grandmother and daughter and granddaughter and grandfather and son and grandson there. When you hear people talk about keeping community together that way, if community matters to you, you'll get a chill. Because in those moments you recognize that's why we're human. We're not human because of how well we kill or how successfully we prey upon other species. We became human long before we made the first tools. Because the first real creation of what would become humanity was its ability to form community and see to the well-being and the needs of all before attending to the wants and desires of one or a few. It gives me a chill because I guess it feels kind of rare, because in the ongoing discussion about whether or not the richest people in this country should actually be paying taxes commensurate with their wealth, and the resistance to that concept is the resistance to community. But in that household where we were on that Friday, the concept of community is alive and well. And they are determined to keep it. And they will do whatever must be done to keep it. We left that home. I wish there was some way I could figure out to order our Christmas standing rib roast from them. My God, it would be good. They use no antibiotics in raising their animals, no hormones, none of that. The animals aren't standing there rib cage to rib cage like one of those god-awful confined animal feedlot operations, CAFOs. Oh, I bet it's delicious. I heard tales of the hamburgers, and they're just, Sorry, I don't mean to put off the vegetarians in the audience. It's just really yummy. But then we went to see some of the streams that were threatened. And again, it was cold, but no precipitation flying or anything. By this time, silly me. I ran off without anything to cover my little head. I picked up a knit cap at a bait shop, where I also picked up some smoked fish to bring home to the family. Smoked fish is real big up there. Smoked trout, smoked whitefish. I was no sooner in the door than Ferg was looking at me going, I heard there was smoked fish coming. Give it up, Dad. And so, having arrived home late on Saturday night, we sat and had a little midnight feast of smoked whitefish and smoked trout. And it was delicious. I mean, food porn. Really delicious. I took a bunch of pictures. One of them is posted at headonradionetwork.com in the little photo rotator there. Sitting on the banks of the running waters of the Tyler Fork, the evergreens clad in a last little remaining bit of snow from the snow that had come about a week before but had long since gone, most of it. Snow came again right after I left. I imagine it is nothing but beautiful up there right now. Cold and beautiful. But we hiked a little ways up the Tyler Fork and just listen to its beautiful rushing on. Saw places on the bank where the whitewater foam had literally frozen in place. Foam frozen. Not ice. Foam. And the stillness, oh, the stillness was beautiful. There's a person who is very special to Northland College there in Ashland, and his name is Sigurd Olson, who in the 60s and 70s defined a sort of new approach to, or expanded the approach to environmentalism. There's an institute on the campus of Northland College called the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute. there was a quote from him, a plaque on a wall, and I had to stop and photograph so that I would have it for later, like for now. Because the profundity of it just grabbed me by the throat. Only when one comes to listen, only when one is aware and still, can things be seen and heard. Everyone has a listening point somewhere, some place of quiet, where the universe can be contemplated with awe. Back on Thursday night, I'd had a conversation with Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins after the panel discussion. And he asked what we were doing on Friday, and I told him we were going out to see the lay of the land. And he said, when you get to the source of the bad river, put your hands in Lake Caroline. And he just, without any elaboration, just looked at me and said, there's a lot of power there. And so after we left the magnificent stillness, broken only by the sound of the water of the Tyler Fork, we got back in our van. And we drove down another road until we came to Lake Caroline. Now, these were lakes. We're not talking about seas like Lake Superior. These were lakes. These were little holes in, well, big holes in the ground, gouged out by the glaciers tens of thousands, millions of years ago. And Lake Caroline was frozen almost solid. But a little rivulet runs out of one end of Lake Caroline, and that is the absolute source of the Bad River. You can step across it. And there is something powerful in the source of something, the beginning of something. And yeah, I found a little bit of quiet time. And you know me, you know how I talk on this program. I don't get on my knees to anyone or anybody. Won't do it. But for this, I dropped to my knees. And in that cold, and it was cold, I plunged both hands into that lake and just held them there. Listening to what Sigurd Olsen had said, thinking about what Sigurd Olsen had said, everyone has a listening point somewhere, some place of quiet where the universe can be contemplated with awe. And the river there that was starting just a couple of feet from me had supported countless generations. Of people living well, not merely subsisting, but thriving on that land. And that was the other thing that grabbed me. Before the advent of many of ours and my European ancestors, before they, quote unquote, discovered, use of that word just kills me, discovered America. How do you discover something that has a larger human population on it than Europe or Africa or Asia? How do you discover that? Just saying. But there were peoples living all over this continent who were living better than just ordinary people. Day-to-day people who were living, can you imagine this? Who were living better lives even than princes and kings in Europe. Who had more laughter, who had more food, who had more clean water, who had more clean living conditions, who had more leisure time, who had more pleasure than kings and princes in Europe. And I just looked around that where I was, and I thought, my goodness gracious, everything's here. Everything is here. Fresh water. The ability to build shelter. Furs for keeping warm. The origin myth of the Anishinaabe people said that they came west on a prophecy that said that they would know where they were going when they found the place where food grows on water. And hence their reference, or their reverence, for the wild rice that once, before white folks began poisoning the place, grew in profuse abundance. Think about that phrase, where food grows on water. By God, when you get to a place where the food grows on the water, you are home. Because food that grows on water means that you're not going to have to bust your ass tilling the soil. You're not going to have to bust your ass at much of anything. Once you get over that essential human hump of how to live in the given environment where you are, you've pretty much got it made. And the other thing I noticed is that within the, if you'll call it religious, I don't know, a spiritual tradition there, I like that better. If I understand it correctly, Gichimanido, the creator, so loved his people, her people, its people, that it gave this place of abundance to them. And so there was this loving relationship between creator and created. It's a far cry from the angry gods of desert places running around looking for people to smite. Have you ever noticed that? The more temperate and abundant the environment, the more the gods reflect that. Think about old Jehovah. Think about Huitzilopochtli. You know, in the arid conditions from whence the Mexica people came toward the Valley of Mexico, Huitzilopochtli literally had to be fed with human blood in order to sustain him. Old Jehovah? Is there a more vicious deity on this planet? Or a more viciously imagined deity? But when your world is defined by plenty, it's a different story. And plenty there was in that land where the food grows on water. I want to see if I'm going to try to play something here, and it's going to be really raw because I'm just trying to get it out of my phone and through the microphone. Let's see if this works at all. Okay, I'm going to have to volume up. See if you can hear this. if you heard that, that is the sound of a river being born. That is the sound of the origin of life-giving itself. That is, in the waning days of autumn of 2012, water running out from under the frozen surface of Lake Caroline into a channel barely a yard wide and certainly not a foot deep to form the beginnings of the Bad River. I will be a long time, if ever, forgetting that trip. I don't think I can. I hope I don't. I told the new friends I made up there that when the parasites surrender and they know that they have won this round and protected that land, that I would very much like to come back and bring my little tribe with me and join them in celebrating their victory. Because I am convinced that they're going to win this. And they'll win this by following the leadership of the Bad River Band as they stand up, or perhaps sit down, and say no. The most powerful word in any language. And you know, of course, I do love language. And I loved hearing a few words. And goodness gracious, can I say it? Anishinaabemowin? And the most important word I heard of that language is something that was said repeatedly to me, and which I say in return to them. Megwich. Thanks. So it is about 4 minutes past the hour. We'll take a little break and come back. Michael has sent something along. He said, I've sent you a song called Superior by Colin Gowell. Good tune, set in Wisconsin, if you need to get that other song unstuck from your head, and I do. So like I said, we'll take a little break and we'll come back. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Time. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Wow, what a song, huh? Colin Gowell, G-A-W-E-L, if I'm pronouncing it right, formerly had a band named Watershed, Michael tells me. That song, Superior. Huh. Yeah, after the program's over, I'm going to go back and see if I can get it to just turn into an earworm. And yeah. A lot of email rolling in during the filibuster, which I will get at, you know, like right now. This is conversation radio, after all. I'm not the only guy around here who does any talking. First of all, I want to thank those of you who have contributed in the first hour to keep everything going here. I'm proud to say that we have met the evening's fundraising goal and maybe even by 25 bucks or so started catching up. And thanks again to those of you who contributed even while I wasn't behind the microphone to keep things going because it meant we were paying bills. Thank you very much. I try to get thank you notes out. In regard to contributions, our buddy Horst wrote in. He said, you asked a while back what our feelings were as to having our contributions mentioned on the air, and I've been meaning one of these days to get around to dropping my two bits on one of these days, which is, first and foremost, do whatever you find helpful in driving support for the show. As a general matter, I'm entirely willing to have my contributions noted when they come in, but not necessarily the amount. I'll get to the not necessarily part in a minute. I decided years, ago, to make a monthly contribution to the Horn in whatever amount that I could comfortably give. You've seen many of us members of the Horn family endure all sorts of ups and downs with employment and other circumstances. I know I've had my share. So that comfortable level of contribution can vary. My take is that whether I have $5 or $100 to contribute in any given month, it is not the amount that I give which gives me pride, but rather the simple fact that I give what I can, and thankfully it seems I'm always able to give at least something. So I'm proud to be counted as a Horn contributor any old time. The amount I give, however, is a matter neither for pride when I have plenty nor for shame when I have little or nothing, so unless there's a specific reason for broadcasting that information, I'd rather not have it disclosed. One reason I can think of, as noted in Not Necessarily Above, is when I've made my contribution during a fundraising challenge or even on a normal day, and by reminding the listeners how much is left to make the stated goal, it becomes clear how much I've given. If people can work out for themselves what that amount is, I have no problem with that. I just don't want an overt point made of it, unless, of course, you find it useful to do so for any reason at all. So with that said, I'm skipping over to PayPal and going to get December off to an earlier start than's my want. Maybe by month's end I'll find enough for a little extra more. It's plenty, Horst. It's plenty. And thank you. Thank you, Brandon, for your kind note. This from Dr. John, under the subject line, best point of the night, or perhaps ever. You can't do anything to the earth, but it'll tattle on you. Hear, hear, says Dr. John. In addition to plow scars, we can tell from chemical samples of phosphorus levels if humans or animals ever lived on a patch of ground without any visible evidence. And more than tattle, the earth has a way of brushing away human life if we get too obnoxious. See deforestation and collapse on Rapa Nui as a case in point. The problem is, these mining bastards have a way around the problem. They don't live in the nest they foul. The people who get the brushing away are those who can't get away from the fouling. Wow. I think you just out-profounded me, John. The people who get the brushing away are those who can't get away from the fouling. And necessarily, that's why the Chris Kleins of the world don't live where they foul. He's out toddling around on a yacht named Mind Games. M-I-N-E, Games. Mind Games. Because what he does to other people's communities and other people's lives are just games for the millionaires and the billionaires who sleaze and slither and slide and slurry along among us. Dr. John Close is saying, regarding the Bad River Ojibwe, I can't imagine a greater tragedy than a people who have fought off encroaching greed and rapacious white settlers for centuries than having their land and subsistence destroyed by absentee mining. Yeah, Dr. John, it is the ultimate indignity, isn't it? But the other side of that coin is why I have so much hope for this struggle. Because I don't think they're going to let it happen. I think they, if anyone, can stop it. And the depth of the admiration and the respect I have for what they're bringing to bear to stop it, well, it's almost inexpressible. Jenny writes in from Wisconsin. She said, Bob, the best filibobster ever. I've been in tears listening to you describe our land. I have to go now and get my daughter from our little glacial ski hill. I've met Jenny and her daughter. I'll listen to the rest tomorrow. Thank you so much for caring. Thank you so much for telling everyone about the wonders of the Pinokies and the Bad River. And they are wonderful. I'd like to be able to go up at... Shucks, I'd have so much to learn to do to be a decent fisherman or anything. I guess I'd just have to make do with going up there and walking around among those waters and in those hills. My God, it's amazing. The ore sticks out of the earth. The iron ore sticks out of the earth. You can take a magnet and it'll go plink to the rock. You get the idea. In the course of wandering through the visitor center, there was the picture of some guy, I can't remember his name, who in 1850-something was the first white guy to wander through there with one of those little geologist picks and identify some of the ore deposits. You know, there's copper up there, there's gold up there. Jesus, Bob, don't say that! The parasites, but they already know, what am I saying? But that's the way I guess we are, sadly. It's the ugly dark side of science. Early so-called naturalists coming into a so-called unknown region. Yeah, ask the people who live there. Oh, no, we don't know nothing about this place. We've only been here for a few millennia. God. But coming through and prospecting and writing back saying, wow, there's a bunch of stuff under the ground here that we could dig up and make money on. Ugh, the mindset. But that's how it all got started. But Jenny, there are wonders there. I'd like to just get in a canoe and float for a while. You know, there are little Class 1 and Class 2 rapids. Nothing to get too worked up about. I'd love to be there in August during the ricing season and see that done. Our buddy Andy wrote in. Subject line, "You the man, Bob, highly inspiring." Andy says, "You're amazing, man. What an inspiration to try and stop the ravagers of open pit mining before it gets started. I don't know of anyone out there trying to save our planet at this preemptive level than you. Nip it in the bud before the scorched earth policy kicks in." Thank you, Andy, thank you. But I'm nothing. I'm less than nothing. The work is being done by dedicated people that, like my hosts, Bill and Pete, and all the wonderful people that they introduced me to, Professor David up at Northland College, Professor Brandon, Professor Mark, Chairman Wiggins, Ms. Koski, Phoebe, JP, Jim. Just impassioned, dedicated people who love where they are and love it not just for themselves and what it has been, but for what it may yet be. And so they're the real heroes in this. And if I serve a purpose, the purpose I hope I serve is simply to tell others about the amazing work that they do so that their work can in turn be supported. Tell about the struggle going on so that it will, because every time that that parasitic extraction wants to go somewhere, they always try to do it under the deep, dark, still and cover of the night, as it were. They want to do it away from sunlight. They want to do it away from visibility. They want to do it away from transparency. They want to do it outside the notice of people who would realize what an immoral, what an unconscionable act it is that they are doing. And so that's what this is. This is just an attempt to tell you so that you can then go and inform yourself. Pinoke is P-E-N-O-K-E-E. Bad River sounds just like it sounds. Go use any search engine you choose and learn about it. And talk to somebody else. Get conversations going about this. Because eventually, when we build the great weight of determination against something, then our friends up there in Ashland and Iron Counties know that they are not laboring alone. They know that there is a tremendous weight of goodwill that is behind them. Even if it's among people who have never and will never go there. Whenever I go on one of these little journeys, it's always sad to leave the place. Because I always wonder if I'll ever see it again, especially when it's a place as special as some of the places I've seen in Wisconsin, especially this place most recently. I always wonder if I'll see it again. And I hope I do. I hope very much that I do. I hope I really can go up and celebrate when they stop these monsters. But even if I don't, I know that I have seen it firsthand. And I know that in seeing it, I have been the recipient of a gift. A very, very rich gift indeed. So thanks, Andy. And an email came in from our buddy Tom out in California. Going back to last week before I got on the plane, Tom writes in, I was talking about Mind Games, the yacht there. I even heard that maybe it's got a helipad on it. Maybe it's even got a little private submarine. I mean, this is real Goldfinger, Dr. No, Bond villain kind of creepiness, this Chris Klein. Our buddy Jim, noting by email about these parasites, he said, these folks are the Morlocks, of which H.G. Wells wrote in The Time Machine. And I think Jim is right. You know, one of the wonderful traditions in Wisconsin is Friday fish fry. I love that tradition. I had never had walleye. And I had it. My God, the filet took up the whole plate. It was just amazing. This ain't no Mrs. Paul's. But we were sitting around over Friday fish fry, and, you know, we'd been having wonderful conversations all along, and I looked at my hosts and I said, after a few trips up here, and the way I feel about Wisconsin, I said, I've just about gotten to the point that I feel like this is the United States answer to the Shire. Everybody I've met here has been genial and decent and kind. And even the people, even people who are oppose each other politically to a certain extent still try to be decent about it. And I said, after a while, I begin to wonder if y'all realize that the rest of the country is not like this. Because it's my experience that it really isn't. It's certainly not this way in Appalachia. I never experienced it to be this way in the Deep South. I've never experienced what I experience in Wisconsin anywhere else. Now, anywhere else is pretty big country. I mean, I've never been to Oklahoma. I mean, I've never been to California or Arizona or Oregon or Washington or spent a lot of time in New York or up in no. So maybe I'm mainly just gauging it by Appalachian culture and Southern culture, which is the amount, which is mostly what I've been exposed to. There's something really special in that state, and I acknowledge I've not been, you know, down toward the Chicago, the exurbs part of Wisconsin, or I've never been to Milwaukee or anywhere like that. Mostly, I've seen little rural towns, which is what I find myself most fascinated with. Because I think you can tell more about a place by its small towns than by its big cities in some ways. Because big cities are self-definitional. Whereas small towns tend to capture what remains of the cultural origins of a place. And I keep running across these really cool small towns in Wisconsin where, well, but we all had a big laugh at the table when I said, I've come to the conclusion that Wisconsin is the Shire. I said, you know, and I asked that question, you know, do people understand? And the answer came, no, people really do think the rest of America is like Wisconsin. And I said, you know, I feel like just going, wait a minute. Don't you realize, I mean, it's outside the borders of the Shire, don't you realize there are orcs and goblins and dark riders and ring wraiths and necromancers and trolls and, there's crazy stuff out there. This is worth saving and protecting. Yeah. And I mean that with a great deal of love and respect. Now, Tom wrote in And he said, back last Monday, I think you mentioned with surprise that some one percenter super yacht that was for charter. And I had, because I'd talked about the fact that this Chris Klein character has this Mind Games yacht, and he lets it to rent. You know, I'm such a little prole, I keep thinking of, you know, if I had a nice boat, you'd probably have to drag me kicking and screaming off of it. So Tom says, in reality, most of these oversized abortions are available to charter, and Tom knows his boats. He says, do realize it's not because they need the money. It's because they want it all. Tom gets the concept probably better than I do. It's not because they don't charter these monster yachts that they own because they need the money. It's because they want it all. You see, these yachts are businesses, not just private yachts. The charter rates run from $100,000 to $500,000 a week, plus tips for the crew. Now, clearly, there isn't a lot of demand for rentals like this, and that's important. You wouldn't want to lose your tax write-off, after all. The rule of thumb is that maintenance and operating budget for these behemoths is 10% of the original cost. You can see prices. Good for bragging rights. And of course, no self-respecting billionaire would spend his own money when interest rates are so low. Better to be invested and increase your business expenses with a boat loan. A nice big annual loss is the result, says Tom. A nice way to offset other income and this is important because he put it in caps, let the rest of us pay their taxes. I should hasten to point out, says Tom, that this is decidedly not the situation for people with modest boats who, some of them are legitimate businesses and most are simply private boats. And now, the Moran Monday nomination, says Tom. The American citizenry, who have allowed our supposed representatives to be lobbied to permit, no, encourage this nonsense. I need, says Tom, to replace the rotten handle of my pitchfork. And of course he speaks truth. It's tax dodges like this that have put us in the spot we're in. And that's what makes a little bit of to expand upon Tom's Moran Monday nomination, that's what it puts a little bit more Moranity into the present dumbass debate about the so-called fiscal cliff. You know, if you've got a bad tooth and it hurts and it aches, but you're terrified of the dentist, you'll put up with a lot of pain before you, and a lot of worry before you'll finally say, let's go to the dentist, if you can afford to go to the dentist. Well, the fiscal cliff is like that. I've heard fiscal cliff, fiscal cliff, fiscal cliff, as Orwellian as that is, until I'm about puked of it. And I'm just saying, let's go over already. And I hope this is not the same thing as being all burn, baby, burn, about Wall Street or the bailout of the auto manufacturers. I've read a lot about the fiscal cliff, and it doesn't look like there's just a shitload that happens to us who actually carry the country, as compared to the billionaires who are afraid that they might actually have to pay for the privilege a little bit of being American citizens. But even within the let the Bush tax cuts expire debate, there's a little bit of a con, don't you know? Because even if the Bush tax cuts are allowed to expire, the rich are still going to have a really, really low tax rate. And that's on income. and most of them aren't working for a check. A lot of them are deeply invested in the stock market, and as a consequence, the only tax they pay is a capital gains tax of stupidly low percentages and proportions. And so when the Repiglicans sit there prattling along about the horror of raising taxes on the job creators, they're snickering up their sleeves about us rubes who don't realize that even if the tax rate, Bush tax cuts expire, the richest of the rich will still be paying that insanely low capital gains rate that allows the richest of the rich to pay roughly 15% when the people who carry this country on their backs pay in excess of 30%. See what I mean? But the for-profit media keep on prattling about the fiscal cliff. Even though they don't have to worry about the difference between a Medicare eligibility age of 65 and 67. What would it feel like? Think about this for a minute. What would it feel like to get to 65 years of age and realize that once upon a time that would have meant that after surviving without health insurance up to that age, bang, you could go to the doctor. No, they raised it to 67. And what happens if you get sick and die at 66? You know, if that world existed where ghosts really could haunt people, if you died at 66 because you still couldn't go to the doctor because you had to wait till you were 67, wouldn't you just go and haunt some Republican bastard? I mean, wouldn't you, like, throw shit at him out of the refrigerator? Wouldn't you do all those poltergeisty things? And wouldn't he or she damned well deserve it? Oy! You know, I had a nomination from Ron in Raleigh, who stirred up the Hornet's Nest two Mondays back with his nomination of Tom Hartman over the whole atheist thing. Ron in Raleigh writes today, he said, before I leave for today's 12-hour shift, I'd like to propose another Moran Monday nominee or nominees. Today's nominees are President Obama and his fiscal cliff negotiation team. I've been hearing that the president and his team are willing to put the full amount of the return to Clinton-era tax rates on the table. Instead of returning to the 39.7% rate, they're hinting that they would be willing to accept a 37% rate. In exchange for this piddling increase, the Obama team is going to give the Repiglicans the increase in Medicare eligibility age. These guys have to be the worst negotiators in history. As it was said years ago that only Nixon could go to China, now the meme is that only a Democrat can dismantle the New Deal. This is happening because Barack Obama agrees with the Repiglican position on entitlements. He's expressed a desire to make a grand bargain since before he became president. The best play on the fiscal cliff is to let it happen and then work for middle-class tax cuts. However, this won't happen. The president will put the gun to his own head and threaten to pull the trigger, and the Repiglicans will let him. You know what that put the gun to his own head reference is. Yeah, that's from Blazing Saddles. You know the scene. You can look it up. It's a fair nomination, but we've got a lot of nominations on this Moran Monday. A lot. Let's see. One of the really neat things I heard about while I was up in Wisconsin was talking to one of my hosts, Bill. Great guy. And he was telling me about a website, an organization called the Cornucopia Institute. Do y'all know about this? Do y'all know about the Cornucopia Institute? It's a great, great organization. They kind of serve as a watchdog on things organic and so forth. They describe themselves as promoting economic justice for family-scale farming. And Bill asked me to check them out, and I did, and it's amazing. For those of us who live out here in a place where, in places where organic is kind of dodgy and you get what you get and you hope you're doing the right thing, this has proved to be of invaluable, it's proved to be invaluable. Learned, you know, I've been kind of on a high fructose corn syrup crusade for a little while. Learned about carrageenan while reading at the Cornucopia Institute. Lots of studies out there saying carrageenan, which is an extract that comes from seaweed, and can be quite organic, it tends to promote gut problems, things like IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, and spastic colon, and, you know, all that stuff that hurts. And so I noticed that, and they've got a trade lobby, carrageenan does. And this nomination is kind of hand-in-hand with what Tom was saying, you know, nominating we us for the stuff we fall for. There's a carrageenan lobby. I don't know why I'd be surprised. There's a lobby for, you know, there's a high-fructose corn syrup lobby. Hell, there's a coal ash waste lobby. Good and good for you. But the story I was reading pointed out that, well, a lot of people buy eggnog this time of year. And so they were pointing out some companies that took the carrageenan out of their eggnog. And lo and behold, one of the ones that didn't was Horizon Organic. And if you're in a place like I am, you see that brand and you think you're buying something good. But you're not necessarily. You know, Horizon Organic Eggnog has carrageenan in it, as opposed to, say, Supernaturals or Organic Valley that doesn't. But it's a process of the the corporatization of organic things. And then there's this. Organic eggs. You know, most of us probably know how nasty conditions can be in the livestock business. Hence why I was so pleased to visit that one farm in Wisconsin where the cows were contentedly wandering around the fields doing what thinking cow thoughts and doing cow things, chewing cow cuds. Instead of standing ribcage to ribcage up to their own knees, do cattle have knees, in their own filth? So usually when I go to the grocery store and we're buying eggs, you know, honey, don't forget to bring home a dozen eggs. Yes, dear. I buy Eggland's Best. You know, because you open it up and it's got the cute little pink breast cancer ribbon stamped on the eggshell. That should be a giveaway, that they're tied in with some pretty big players. Then again, whoever decided to allow 5-Hour Energy to promote a pink lemonade version of their little toxic energy drink, with profits go, you know, the more you use, the more they'll pay. So buy some 5-Hour Energy pink lemonade today. This is terribly perky. But whoever said, yeah, let's do that, should probably be out of a job. The Food and Drug Administration is investigating the 5-Hour Energy people, because it seems that kids, because, you know, you can just buy it right there at the counter of your local Rippy Mart, and there's been more than a little handful of kids dropping dead from drinking that stuff. Right? But anyway, Eggland's Best, these are organic, you know, they're never fed chickens to make, you know, they're not cannibal eggs. And you know, you imagine a place where the chickens can go in and out of the hen house. And it's all very nice. Only it's not. Reading at Cornucopia Institute, I found out that, no, it turns out that in the 1 through 5 egg rating scale that they promulgated on their report card, Eggland's Best gets 1 egg out of a potential 5. This is the description that they give to a 1 egg report. Okay, first of all, if you get 5 eggs, and here, let's give credit where credit's due. I don't know, maybe some of you live near where you can get some of this. Lazy 69 Ranch out of California, 5 eggs out of 5. Bee Heaven Farm out of Homestead, Florida, 5 eggs out of 5. Kingbird Farm out of Berkshire, New York, 5 out of 5. Krause Farm out of Engadine, Michigan, 5 out of 5. Old Friends Farm out of Amherst, Massachusetts, 5 eggs out of 5. Vermont, 5 eggs out of 5. And what those 5 eggs mean is that producers in this top tier manage diverse small to medium scale family farms. They raise their hens in mobile housing on well-managed and ample pasture, or in fixed housing with intensively rotated pasture. They sell eggs locally or regionally under the farm's brand name, mostly through farmers markets, food co-ops, and or independently owned natural grocery stores, and sometimes through larger chains like Whole Foods. That's 5 out of 5. Well, then there's 4 out of 5, and they're doing a pretty good job. Then there's very good at 3 eggs out of 5, complying with minimum USDA standards. Then there's 2 eggs out of 5 that are fair, with some questions remaining about compliance with federal standards. And then there's 1 egg out of 5. And that's where we find, that's where we find Eggland's Best. Of Jeffersonville, PA, sold nationwide, making people think they're buying organic stuff that ain't necessarily. The Cornucopia scorecard noting that nationwide chains like, or nationwide businesses like Barnstar Family Farms, Big Island Poultry, Bob LaPlace, Canoe Creek, Chino Valley Ranchers, Circle JD Ranch, Eggology, Eggland's Best, on and on and on, all 1 stars out of 5. Brands with a 1 egg rating are generally produced on industrial-scale egg operations that grant no meaningful outdoor access. Outdoor access on these operations generally means a covered concrete porch that is barely accessible to the chickens. Don't y'all go out there. It's a dangerous world out there, my darling little hens. Don't you leave. Means of egress from the buildings are intentionally small to discourage birds from going outside and make it possible for only a small percentage of birds to have access to the outdoors. No producers in this category were even willing to participate in the Cornucopia Institute's project, and none shared their production practices with Cornucopia researchers. This is disturbing to many organic consumers, since transparency has always been viewed as a hallmark of the organic food movement. So thus I find myself in a conundrum, because, you know, you'll pay a good buck and a half extra for a dozen of those Eggland's Best with their pretty little pink ribbon stamp on them, because you think you're doing the right thing. But then you read this and you realize there's just not a hell of a lot of difference between them and the corporate farm. Well, I guess maybe the only difference is that they're not feeding chicken to chickens. If that is in fact the case. So the Moran nomination goes to we consumers and also to the people who corrupt and pervert our desire to eat non-toxic food. But also from my newfound source at the Cornucopia Institute, which I'm going to be reading a lot of apparently. Time magazine had on its cover a picture of a bunch of food with the words, "What to eat now." And Cornucopia Institute, responding to that, produced an essay that said, called "Organic Food, Organic Food Justice for the 99%. They write, last week's Time magazine cover story by celebrity physician Dr. Mehmet Oz called organic consumers snooty and described an organic diet as elitist. Snooty and elitist for not wanting to eat poison. Want to bet if you go to the Dr. Mehmet Oz house, you'll see no small amount of organic food in the pantry and in the fridge. Anyway, the Cornucopia Institute folks write, concern over pesticides, animal welfare, fostering local economies, and pollution turn people toward organic and local foods, and that's bad for business for the chemical and industrial farming industries. No wonder they have launched an all-out media offensive against the booming organic industry. I would add that they've also tried to co-opt it, as seen in, like, the Eggland's Best Egg. Right. Their paternalistic message, to shut up and eat our food, more please, is no longer working. Americans are no longer ignoring the mounting scientific evidence that pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, hormones, antibiotics, and other drug residues are harming us, even at low levels, and especially our children. The agrochemical industry will not win the hearts and minds and stomachs of Americans and has turned to a more sinister message, likening a diet of conventional foods to the 99% diet and a chemical-free organic diet as elitist. Jesus. There's an economic discussion to be had here. These right-wing horses' rear ends, and most of the people in these corporations are right-wing horses' rear ends, well, they're fond of the free market, aren't they? They love them some free market. But if people begin to make consumer choices based upon what's poisonous and what's not poisonous, in other words, making free market decisions, and if more and more people want organic and more people want pesticide-free food, more and more people realizing, hey, we're breathing enough of it, we're swallowing enough of it, we're absorbing enough of it through our skins just by living every day, let's not eat it too. If people begin to stand up and say things like, hey, we'd like to have it labeled when our food is made out of genetically modified organisms. You know, when our potatoes have a gene spliced in it from a goat's gut. Or when our corn has genes from a frog's ear. Well, then that's snooty and elitist, It's no longer free market. Notice how that works? See how that works? Jesus. If you want to read the opinion editorial piece, go to Cornucopia, CornucopiaCA.org, cornucopia.org, and look at organic, look for organic food justice for the 99%. You'll find it quite telling. And the reason that they're pushing back the way they are, and I think this needs to be addressed, is because there is a free market threat to toxic food. People want to eat food that is actually not poisonous. And it threatens the business model of the poisoners. Yeah, see, Randy in Pennsylvania understands, hey, where's the eye of newt gene in my non-GMO corn? It's not there. It's just corn. But do you understand? I mean, I'm sorry to say things like, do you understand? But kind of just falls out that way. But that's kind of profound. That the huge agribusinesses cannot do business in the free market unless they get to poisonous some. The only thing snooty in the organic discussion is the snootiness involved with people with corporations that, well, by God, we get to poison you a little bit because it's good for our quarterly profit and loss statement. We wash our lettuce real good. We try to get all the poopy molecules off our lettuce so you won't get no E. coli, but never now and again you're going to have some people drop dead of it in the peanut butter and the green beans and the lettuce and whatnot, because, well, I mean, that's freedom in America, and let's all sing. God. Going to be a very, very busy little Moran Monday. I get the notion. Email in coming from Kate out on the Front Range. She said, what you're describing is my home here in Montana. Here, most folks don't believe there is anywhere else. Small town community, friendly folks, fried fish, and wonderful wild meat stews are commonplace. A lot of your monologue had me in tears, she says. Here are many bubbling headwaters, sacred waters that sound exactly like your sounds. Please save that recording and listen to it when you need a trip to Horseshoe Lake. I'd suggest you play it often for we here in the audience. It's so much more nurturing than those cuts from preachers. My tears come from the fact that there is fracking and extraction already happening here, all over the state, polluting the sacred waters. We've already been pushed over the edge. Signed, Kate, on the Front Range. Yeah. Oh, I know. And hanging here on the wall of the studio, I have a painting, like I told you all about, that was handed to me back in September, brought to me all the way down to Madison, Fighting Bob. Jenny brought it. A painting of a little sand hills of Wisconsin that are being blasted to smithereens in their own rights for profit because it's real yummy sand for doing fracking and poisoning somebody else's water somewhere else. So naturally, we'll poison the people who live where the sand hills are by blasting the bejesus out of that and letting them breathe some polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and what the hell, you know, the poison's already in the food and we're all going to die anyway. So what's the, you know. Rich, writing in, says, when you played the sound of that river, I was reminded of a beautiful yet sad song that I'm sure you're familiar with, Goodbye to a River by Don Henley. Oddly enough, Rich, I'm not. I'm going to have to go and find that, and we'll play it sometime. Signed, Rich in Sacramento. Thank you, Rich. Marty asking, if Wisconsin's the Shire, where is Mordor? Mordor is wherever there is some dark tower full of corporate parasites, dark lords. And the thing is, what's the word I'm looking for? Mordor has been decentralized. There we go. That's what I'm looking for. Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Choose your partner for the Virginia Reel.
Do-si-do.
Mind if we dance with your dates?
Hey, Jim, what's happening?
You?
Just glad to be home.
I'm sure you are. Yeah, I did quite a bit of traveling in Wisconsin when I used to have to go to the Great Lakes Naval Training Center.
That's where my father went through boot camp in the Second World War.
No, yeah, I've been there many times.
Where exactly is that?
Oh, it's near Waukegan. Not too far from Chicago.
Okay. We still got his photograph of his graduating class, as it were, his company. I was just looking at it today, and that's still in Illinois, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It certainly is. Yeah, your references to the Shire and the Tolkien trilogy is pretty accurate, because, you know, Mordor and the powers of the Dark Lord, Sauron or whomever, is pretty close to everybody outside of what little enclave there may be to the what we call the Shire. And the thing about it is, you know, carry this analogy one step further. You have so many golems who were once decent people. I mean, Gollum was a hobbit himself.
Yep.
Until he put the Ring of Power on his finger.
Right. It was he and his cousin Deagle.
Or Schmeagol, whatever.
Yeah, Schmeagol and Deagle.
Yeah, whatever. But that's what, you know, in my opinion, that's what's happened to the representatives we have in Congress.
They put on the Ring of Power and...
They put on the Ring of Power.
It becomes their precious.
Yeah, because they're my precious, my precious, my precious. And it basically corrupts them. And the only thing they represent are their own interests. And they come back every 2, 4, 6 years, whatever, or 2 or 6 years. And they try to put on some type of representation or false face to get them sent back. That's exactly what's going on, in my opinion. You know, back to the people who are from Wall Street and K Street. Because that's who gives them the money.
Right. And that's and it's all done for those people.
Yeah, and...
I was told the projections, for instance, for what this company hopes to... drag and blast and gouge and pinch and whatever out of the Pinocchio Hills. And, you know, it's a project that's 20... I mean, because you know what mountaintop removal is, right, Jim?
Yeah, I do. And
yeah, well, this project is 22 miles long and a half a mile wide.
And the people who do it, excuse my French, but they don't shit where they eat.
No. They don't. They're out at sea on their yachts and so forth.
Exactly. And they can afford to buy food that is healthy for them, but yet they leave the food or that's been poisoned by a lot of this stuff up to the 99% whom they hope will die.
Well, there's an element of die quickly, like Alan Grayson talked about, to all of this.
Well, I mean, you know, as long as they're productive and serve their interests, they can be allowed to live. But number 44, serve the ship and live.
Right.
And that's their attitude. And a lot of the people who support this crap, these teabaggers, and other people who have join the right-wing elements of the Republican Party, they're the victims, but are too stupid to realize it.
Useful idiots.
Yeah, like those idiots.
Shock, cannon fodder for the culture wars.
Exactly, exactly. And are glad to, and they think that they're going to win their country back. For what? Not for them.
From whom? From the people who don't want to be poisoned. From the people who want to drink clean water. From the... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've been trying to stomach it. But every time I cut on Fox News, and before, a couple of weeks ago, I would never turn to that channel. And I have never seen such a bunch of right-wing idiots who twist and pervert the truth, the likes of which you've never seen.
Well, Jim, you have a genius for going places that you didn't know I wanted to go and opening doors, because by mentioning Fox News, you have just created the conversational space for another another Moran Monday nominee.
Yeah?
Yeah, the Fox News viewer. Horst turned me on to this over the weekend. I was there last week, toward the end of last week, and I was going, what? And you know, he had pre-checked it to make sure it wasn't The Onion or Andy Borowitz or any of those funny people. No, this is for real. You're going to love this, Jim. It was released on PR Web Newswire. The results of a four-year study show that Americans who obtain their news from Fox News Channel have an average IQ of 80, which represents a 20-point deficit when compared either to the U.S. national average IQ of 100, a conservative nonprofit group called the Intelligence Institute tested 5,000 people using a series of tests that measured everything from cognitive aptitude to common sense, and found that people who identified themselves as Fox News viewers and conservative had, on average, significantly lower intelligence quotients. Fox,
well, Bob, well, these viewers of Fox News and the perpetrator of Fox News have basically destroyed anyone's ability to think critically.
And that's not an accident.
No, it's not. It's just, it's like I say, it's Dr. Goebbels and his propaganda ministry of enlightenment and whatever would be proud of this crap that's coming over this channel.
Well, the test results kind of blew me away, because it said that test subjects who received their news from other outlets or reported that they just don't watch the news scored an average IQ of 104 compared to 80 for Fox News viewers.
Well, Bob, you know, there are two kinds of people. Those who stick their head in the sand and those who listen to Fox News who have their head up their ass. And once you put it there, they don't want to hear anything else because they are so led and so mistaken by the way the news has been perverted by Rupert Murdoch and his paladins.
And Marty wrote in asking, where is Mordor? I think we just got our answer now, didn't we?
I think we did, yeah. I mean, when I first read Tolkien and stuff like that, and the hobbits with their little hobbit dwellings and their round oars and things of that nature, and Bilbo Baggins and stuff like that back in the 70s, and used to get the calendars that were illustrated by the brothers Hildebrandt. Remember those?
Oh, yeah, I had them all.
I mean, that to me was so idyllic and beautiful. But then, of course, you had to have Sauron, the Ring of Power, and the other peoples who wanted to destroy that idyllic existence of those little hobbits who ran around barefooted with hair on their feet. And then you had, of course, the legendary exploits of Gandalf and, you know, the whole Tolkien trilogy. Tolkien was a very interesting person. He really was. Ironically enough, he was a very devout Catholic.
Yeah, and you know, he had also been through the era of the First World War.
Exactly. He had been through the horrors of the First World War and could see things coming. And I think the reason he wrote his trilogy was to warn man.
Well, it's interesting from a historical perspective, and I don't know if we're right or wrong on this, but, you know, there's the great battle of the First Age in which it seems that evil has been vanquished, but it only goes away to hide for a while. And in The Hobbit, we learn about the necromancer in Mirkwood, right? Remember?
Right.
And then the shadow arises and goes back to Mordor. And, you know, doesn't that look, I mean, because he's writing all of this beginning in the 1930s and up through the 40s, through the Second World War, and it becomes a metaphor for, you know, the defeat of Germany in the First World War, and then the rearming of it and the coming of the Second.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the point I was going to make next, but you made it for me.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm glad you did. But nonetheless, you know, that's what it meant to me when I read the trilogy. And I said, you know, there's more to this than a fairy tale. And at the time when I was reading this, I was a school teacher. And behind my desk was the Hildebrandt calendar. And it turned a bunch of my students on to The Hobbit and Tolkien's works. And I can remember every day these young minds coming up to me, well, have you read this, or what happened at the Bridge of Khazad-dûm, and, you know, the fight against the Balrog?
Yeah.
And I was hard-pressed to keep up with them. I really was. I mean, these young kids were able to see, I think, what we've been talking about. And that's the reason I called tonight, when you were talking about the Shire.
Well, as Kate points out, Jim, it is, you can get this sense in other small town areas. And it's what comes of, I don't know.
Well, you have a sense of community in these small towns, and you have a sense of responsibility to your neighbor and care for your neighbor, which does not exist in the larger cities and the urbanization of America. And it's a much more desirable place in which to live, that's for damn sure. Whether your neighbor cares whether you live or die, or whether you have whatever you need, if you need it.
Yeah, where the worst problem you have is the Sackville Baggins is stealing your silverware.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these larger, well, these corporations and the business models of these, what can I call them?
Parasites. I've really camped out with parasite.
Well, the worshippers of mammon. I mean, hooray for me and to hell with you.
Right.
They don't care.
I've got mine, screw you.
Exactly.
Or as our buddy Bruce describes it, Igamfu. I've got Igamfu, I've got mine, F you.
Yeah, and they do it with such incredible reality to the people who see some of of what they do under the guise of, oh, we're doing what's right for you, and we are representatives of Christ, and we are representatives of so many things that are good, when they're not. It's all a mask.
Well, you might find this interesting as well, Jim. Our buddy Robert over in Japan writes in, and he says, Tolkien also wrote The Lord of the Rings as a protest, because remember, all bad things happen when people start delving deeply in the earth. That's how you wind up finding Balrogs, and that's how you wind up with, you know, when
The destruction of the...
Well, remember when Saruman breeds your average golem or average goblin up into an orc?
Yeah, exactly.
Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings as a protest against how mining was destroying the environment of England. It was one of the first environmental-friendly fantasies. And he says, just speaking from Mordor here in Japan, that they've cleaned things up a bit, no more rainbow-colored skies from the different colors of pollution that would stream through the horizon, and multicolored water as well. Robert says, in fact, Kitakyushu is now known for being one of the cleanest cities in Asia. Of course, there are other Mordors in China, and there are photo books concerning the beauty, monstrosity, color and shape and texture even, of the pollution. Kind of like a horror movie in a photo book form. He says, just my 2 cents worth. But that makes perfectly good sense.
I tell you, I wanted to suggest a book to you. I can't find it anymore, but it was given to me by a friend of mine in the 70s called Wisconsin Death Trip.
Okay.
You can find that. I want you to take a look at it. It's in trade copy, and it's basically photographs of things of that nature and some of the stuff these people were going through, even in Wisconsin, back in the late 19th century.
I saw some late 19th century photography that was shocking, because apparently that region was just subject, especially northern Wisconsin, was just subjected to a sort of Katie bar the door, no holds barred, we're going to get everything. If it's, you know, if it's moving, we'll kill it. If it's not, we'll eat it sort of mentality.
Oh, yeah. And from that book, I remember words like dipsomania and other horrible things.
And even to this day, though, I mean, I was trying to talk while I was there. I was talking a little bit about the diseases and everything that have followed in the wake of mountaintop removal here. And I found out that over in Minnesota, where they still mine this taconite with reckless abandon, that there are clusters of mesothelioma among the miners in the community that are just shocking. But there's not that much national exposure to it, you know, because it's good business.
Keep that quiet, Bob. They don't want people to know about that. And when they do, they're going to put it on TV with some lawyer trying to get a class action lawsuit, and people will say, oh, well, that's just some lawyer trying to make some money. Just like drugs, like Actos, that they've had many, many things for diabetics, and how it causes so many problems.
Yeah, whatever. If it kills them, you know.
Yeah.
They were going to die anyway.
Yeah, of course, the Takeda Corporation is going nuts because of this stuff. Who produced this stuff?
Right. Oh, I hope I didn't mean to lead anybody astray. But I got emails in as soon as I mentioned that supposed study of the IQ of Fox viewers. Apparently, it's an elaborate hoax.
They don't have IQ, Bob. They've got counter IQ.
I never knew that IQ could work in negative numbers, but welcome to algebra, right?
Exactly. The left is zero.
We just invert it and it's to the right of zero.
Whatever. I want you to do me a favor if you can. And
okay.
I want to dedicate this song, and if you can Google it up, and I want you to dedicate it to the 1% and the people who are trying to lead others in so many bad directions. And it's called Walk on the Wild Side by Brooke Benton.
Well, hang on. Let me see if I can find it, okay?
I mean, this sort of blends in with your religious experience and the devotees of the 1%.
Well, there he is.
I wish you'd play it, if you would for me, please.
Well, I'm pulling it up right now, and hopefully we'll get it going. I hope it's good quality. Okay, I got it here. Shall we have a go at it, Jim?
Go for it.
All right, stand by.
I'm going to leave you now.
All right, take care. Bye now. Our good buddy Jim from Brooke Benton, Walk on the Wild Side.
Sinner, hear what I'm saying. Sinner, you've been swinging, not freeing. nights of fun. The odds against going to heaven, 6-1. Nights of fun. The odds against going to heaven, 6-1. Satan is waiting to take your hand. You walk on the wild side. You walk on the wild side. Away from the promised land. One day of prayer and six nights of fun. The odds against going to heaven, 6-1.
Wow. Nice call, Jim. Nice call indeed. Brooke Benton, Walk on the Wild Side. The odds against going to heaven, 6-1. Harry wrote in just a minute ago. He said, I really like Jim's comparison of hobbits being seduced by the ring in Tolkien's trilogy and the behavior of people in official Washington, D.C. Although I used to think of Lord Acton's observation about the dangers of power and how absolute power corrupts absolutely, there's little question in my mind that those who gain power in D.C. by whatever means, member of Congress, chief of staff for congressperson, counsel to powerful, legislative committee, journalist who becomes Washington celebrity, even people who succeed with a nonprofit organization who become famous or infamous, e.g. Ralph Nader, become drunk with it or seduced by it. And all of these kinds of people, even Ralph Nader, can turn into different people once they're given a large amount of power and realize that others are dependent on them. In Washington, there is more concern about power and keeping power and whether people perceive you as powerful than I have seen almost anywhere else, except perhaps in the entertainment industry in Los Angeles. And Harry says a mouthful even with that. But in D.C., the consequences of this addictive hunger for power affect more than just the people who work in Hollywood. It affects people throughout the country. Because if mining or for fracking sand in Wisconsin or iron ore is initiated in backrooms in Washington, then the addiction to power in D.C. is truly sinister. I could say more, but I'll stop here. Bravo to Jim for seeing the more universal message in Tolkien's trilogy. Tolkien was indeed a humble and religious person. He also had a caring and admirable relationship with C.S. Lewis, although they occasionally competed with each other. But Tolkien was a very thoughtful scholar of languages and, as C.S. Lewis once joked in a genial way, a papist. I can readily see how Tolkien may have been asking people to think more deeply about the consequences of both power and of fooling with the original ecology of the land. Thanks, Jack, by the way. Thanks to Jack in Shreveport for pointing out that, the Fox story was a hoax. And it was aimed at us, our side, because we grabbed it immediately and said, huh, well, naturally. Because folks just jumped all over it. Because they wanted it to be true. Over at HuffPo, Michael Glitz writes, you might think that having the study exposed as a hoax just days after a press release touting it was released would mean Nichols was in hot water. Nichols being the originator of it. Far from it, says Blitz. He did strenuously defend PRWeb, which is a website that offers a clearinghouse for press releases and can hardly be expected to vet every single claim made in every single notice that passes from their users to the web. In fact, Nichols said he had to rewrite his press release four times before PRWeb would post it. They sent back the first draft and said it read like BS, he said. PRWeb asked for more details about the study and more specifics until after five drafts later, they were finally satisfied that it met some minimal standards. Once people started poking around into the suspiciously vague nature of the study and the non-existent group that produced it, Nichols said PRWeb suspended the account of the group that posted the press release and demanded a meeting on Monday, December 10th, where they expect Nichols to provide more evidence to back the press release's claims before they will keep the press release up or agree to post any more down the road. But here's the funny part, and it's framed in the form of a question. So, is the unnamed Republican pack of moderate conservatives unhappy about this tempest in a teapot? Probably not. The meme, people who watch Fox News are dumb, is out there and spreading. No matter how often the study is refuted, and it happened within days, the original press release that was picked up as news will still be out there, forwarded and joked about and commented on, like those hoax emails about Bill Gates giving away money to people who send him a message. It's making a social commentary, suggests Nichols, about the lightning spread of this flimsy excuse of a press release. Facts are obsolete, and numbers aren't as objective as they should be. The piece concludes, noting, in other words, don't believe everything you see on the web, even if it's repeated by a news site or a blog you trust, especially if it seems too good to be true. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
This is Edward.
Hey, Edward, how are you?
I'm pretty good. You were talking about Wisconsin and everything, and I have a very dear friend here in Dallas. We've known each other for over 30 years, and he's from Wisconsin. He grew up on a farm, and they had cattle and everything like that, but they also had a lot of maple trees, and they did maple syrup.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of, and I was thinking about it while I was up there, Edward. I remembered back to the first of the Little House series. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Well, the first one was Little House in the Big Woods, wasn't it?
I can't remember that.
And there were, there was a passage in there about her daddy going out maple sugaring. And didn't that take place in the upper Midwest somewhere, either northern Wisconsin or Michigan? I can't remember. Maybe it was Michigan.
It had to, because that's where the sugar maples grow. And they are beautiful trees. In the fall, they turn this golden color. But my friend told me that they'd go out and they'd gather the maple from syrup from the trees. They, I don't know how to explain this to you. But make marks on the tree, cut through the bark in sort of a triangle pattern, and then put a container under it, and then the syrup would drip into it.
Right. They literally tap the trees, and the sap flows out.
Yeah.
And then that culture still exists up there. And one of the folks who was hosting me even has, and when one has a stand of sugar maples, apparently, it is referred to as a sugar bush.
Oh. Well, anyway. My friend Don told me, he said, when they were cooking the maple syrup down, you had to cook it down, everything out in the sugar shack, and then you'd take some of it, and you'd, of course, there was snow everywhere, and you'd pour it on the snow, and it would solidify, and then you'd pick it up and eat it, and that's called maple candy.
Yep, maple sugar candy. And it's delightful.
Yeah. Well, I had some very good times in Wisconsin. I had a professor who moved from East Carolina, my college, to Wisconsin. His parents were getting older, and he was from there, and he taught piano and pipe organ at a branch of the University of Wisconsin in Janesville. So I was in Chicago that day, and somehow I called and got in touch with him, so I jumped the train, went up to Janesville, and then we went over to Madison, went to a concert at the university there. A harpsichordist, I'll never forget her name. She was so fabulous. Her name was Eugenia Ehlers. It's so strange you remember things like that. But anyway, then we went on to his hometown of Reedsburg, Wisconsin. And on a Saturday night, he said, we're going over to the Moorheads. And I said, the who? He said, the Moorheads. I said, who are the Moorheads? He said, Agnes Moorhead's mother and her aunt.
No.
So we went over there, and there was Mrs. Moorhead, and Agnes looked just like her, and her aunt, and we spent the evening watching television, which they loved, these soap operas, and eating curds. Squeaky, squeaky, squeaky.
Squeaky.
I'll never forget that evening as long as I live.
How could you possibly forget something like that, Edward?
Oh, my. Well, anyway, you all take care, and if I don't get back to you, have a very happy holiday.
Well, thank you, Edward, and I hope we'll hear from you before then.
Well, you may.
All right. Happy holidays to you, too. Bye now. Edward calling in from Dallas, and that's one thing I am noticing. You know, for all this talk of a war on Christmas, the proponents of Christmas don't seem very Christmassy this year. It's just not real. And, you know, it's the 10th of December, but it's just not not terribly Christmas-like out there. So, yeah, who knows? Yeah, maybe we're, I don't know. It's just kind of, but then again, I have a hard time getting into the Christmas spirit when the air conditioner's running. I mean, this is not Arizona, nor is it the Gulf Coast, or Florida even. No, what this is a changing planet. And not for the better. Even though it got briskly cold up where I was, it was not as cold as it should have been. Jim with a note for Edward saying, God, I loved Agnes Moorhead. What an actress. And she was. She was a dandy. Endora? Was that DeWitched? That's where most people know her from. Betsy, by the way, pointing out that, yes, it was Laura Ingalls Wilder, Little House in the Big Woods, and yes, it was Wisconsin. And as far as Christmas goes, she says, I am refusing to dress in green and red for work. Let them fire me. That wouldn't be much in the Christmas spirit, now would it? But then again, they just like to talk about it, not necessarily do it. You know, I'd wish happy holidays or whatever to people going through the line, to the TSA folks as I went through the line, you know, taking my shoes off and stuff to get on the airplane. And I know there's been a lot of complaints and everything, but when you're just decent to folks, when you say, hey, hope your holidays are good. Thank you. As if it was the first time anybody'd said it to them in weeks, and maybe it was. Or, you know, this season. Hard to tell. Back to more inmen. By the way, if it's not obvious enough here in the last 27 minutes or so of the program, the lines are open. You know, of course, that our 800 number is still being held hostage. Eventually, one of these days, when there's, you know, some spare money laying around, we're not just flurrying to pay bills, we will hopefully take care of that. But until then, the direct dial number still works, 304-658-3333. You can also get in on Skype. And the Skype handle here, if you've never done it before, just send a contact to Bob Kincaid Horn. BOBKINCAIDHORN, Bob Kincaid Horn, and I'll approve it, and you'll be able to get through on Skype. If we're already friends on Skype, jump right in. It works just fine either way. In the meantime, however, we will go back to the old-fashioned telephone line and see who we've got. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah, it's Jonathan, John from last week.
Hey, how are you, John? Good to hear from you.
Yeah, it's great, hearing you. Of course, I was listening to your talk about Tolkien, J.R. Tolkien, and I wanted to recommend Barbara Tuchman, who wrote A Distant Mirror, because it's basically like it's kind of like a compare and contrast, but not it doesn't do a lot of the whole contrasting, but it shows sort of the similarities between the feudal society of the 14th century and the. I mean, I would describe our sort of labor system here as somewhat feudal as far as, you've got the people making thousands of times what regular workers make, and then
right.
You got the people. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you would bring up A Distant Mirror because I just got done rereading it a couple of months ago. And I'm a huge Barbara Tuchman fan, and, she's got another book that goes with it called The Proud Tower.
I didn't read that.
It's well worth the time. She was inspired, she wrote The Guns of August, and then she was inspired to go back and write A Distant Mirror because she herself saw the similarities between the circumstances leading up to the First World War and the utter madness of the 14th century in Europe.
Right.
And it's, I love that book. I love that book, too, especially the way that she weaves the story of the 13th century, the plague, the social breakdown, the falling apart of the feudal system. She weaves that into the life of one man, Enguerrand the VII, Sire de Coucy.
Right, from France.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, the thing is that it's fascinating to me that, we got the iPods and the iPad factories, and we got the computers and the cable and all this sort of really high-tech technical stuff, but these sort of common denominators are still there. There's nothing is really, I mean, of course, we like to think of ourselves as more civil and more just and more, just less bigoted overall. But when you look at sort of the underlying social structures, how is it really different from the sort of, I've got more than you've got materialistic stuff that was going on way back when? I mean, it just doesn't seem like the underlying social structure is really that different. I just,
No, I agree completely. And in fact, that's one of the challenges of trying to come to terms with the fact that so-called consumer economic choices are also ethical and moral choices. And of course, there is a constant pressure upon us in a capitalist-driven society to ignore that. We're not supposed to notice that those things are that there is a morality behind these things. And there's a certain amount of culpability that has to attach to all of us in these consumer-driven societies, John, when we are participating in the overt abuse of people in it's a mercantilist system, I think, and people who are trapped in, dollar-a-day jobs. The story came out while I was gone, and I'm glad you reminded me of it, that horrifying fire in Bangladesh
at the
clothing factory. Well, it turns out that, of course, that place was manufacturing clothing for Walmart.
Yeah.
And the follow-up to the story was that, in fact, Walmart executives, with their billions of dollars, were the ones who had refused to support the introduction of the safety standards into that factory that would have prevented those god-awful deaths. So it's not just happenstance that there were Walmart goods in that factory. Walmart had enough economic control of that factory to do yay or nay over whether or not there would be safety standards that would allow people to survive a fire.
Yeah, and doesn't it have you seen the movie The Yes Men? It's like a biography documentary type thing. And basically what they did was they covered I think it was Bhopal, India, the disaster there. I don't think it was the same company, but it was extremely similar circumstance.
No, Bhopal was Union Carbide.
Oh, all right, excuse me. I'm sorry. It just seems like the story.
But it's, yeah, it's the same mindset.
Right. It's like those people are so poor and whatever that, you know, the people at the top really didn't give, you know, they didn't care what was going on with their standards or their safety or anything like that. So and that seems to be like a really common theme. It's like the thing with the iPad factory and the people jumping off the roof over in China. I mean, it's all over the place. Even, you know, the mine disaster in West Virginia, was that it? Is that where it happened? Where
the upper Big Branch? Yeah, where 29 people were incinerated instantaneously?
Yeah.
And it goes on. For instance, I'm glad you reminded me. There was a horror recently in northern West Virginia in Harrison County, just to sort of lay out the story so people can know it. A mine there had been permitted by the EPA and the State Department of Environmental Protection, who doesn't protect the environment,
right,
to expand their toxic waste lake.
Okay.
And so they were expanding it. They were trying to build the sides higher so they could pump more toxic waste into it.
Okay.
This, of course, is also a byproduct of unbridled avarice and unbridled capitalism.
Okay.
And as they were trying to build this, a bulldozer operator who was working on the site, the soil that he was trying to compact collapsed into the lake of toxic waste.
Okay.
And the bulldozer had an enclosed cab.
Jeez.
And they searched for a week in this toxic waste, trying to find him. And in the interim, they were given permission by the authorities to start pumping more toxic waste back into this compromised lake.
Right.
But they finally found him, John. In the enclosed cab of his bulldozer, where he could not escape, and drowned. And they still, even though they have found him, they have still not figured out a way to recover his body.
Wow. That's totally absurd. I mean, that's completely...
It's like, evil. It's evil, John. It's evil.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely a complete disgrace. I mean, it's absolutely... You're right. I mean... It's like they've got ways to, what do they have, the miners stuck in Chile, and they had to go all the way down there and get those out, but they can't get one guy in a bulldozer?
Right. In a sea of toxic waste, because who's going to want to go in that? But the larger question I have is for the Consol executive. You know, because this was a mine that was owned by Consol Energy. And the question I have is, what's it like at his home? You know, they sit down to dinner. Well, dear, we lost a man at the mine today. He collapsed into the slurry impoundment. Well, pass the potatoes.
Yeah, but they probably did the same thing that the Bushes did with the Iraq War, the Iraq War casualties. You know, the Bushes basically said, you know, we don't even want to publicize that. Don't even show it on TV.
Well, right. Remember when that old beast Barbara Bush said, why should I trouble my beautiful mind about who died and how many?
Right. All right. Well, you know, if it's, you know, now that you say that, there's actually a website. Can I bring this up?
Sure.
There's a website called Canada Mine Prod, I think. And if anyone ever has any questions for you about, you know, what really happened in Iraq, now I'm warning you, it's not at all not graphic. It's extremely graphic, but it's basically an entire page of pictures from the Iraq War. And it's like, you know, I'm young, so I've grown up with all these, you know, LiveLeak.com. I can handle a lot of graphic stuff. I could only look at this like once. I couldn't go back. And to this day, I remember in detail some of those pictures. It's horrific. So it's like, what they do is they go home and they shut off the TV, or they turn it to some BS, you know, Dancing with the Stars show that has nothing to do with, you know, what's going on in the news or what's affecting the troops or what's affecting workers.
Right. There's a total disconnect. And, for instance, as Jim just reminded me by email, the junior senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, we like to call him Blanche because he's Blanche Lincoln with better hair, is all in a tizzy right now, John. He is having he's having purple polka-dotted kittens with crocheted tails right now because of an upcoming MTV series that's the replacement for the Jersey Shore. It's called Buck Wild, and it's about a bunch of heathen teenagers from the Charleston-Sissonville area who run around doing heathen teenager things like getting drunk and riding their four-wheelers and going swimming in dump trucks. Okay? It's just, it's dumb. It's what you get. It's 21st century modern media. But Senator Joe is all, and he's demanding that MTV pull the plug because it casts West Virginia in a negative light. Meanwhile, meanwhile, Joe Manchin cannot be cannot be bothered to acknowledge the science that's coming out that says that his buddies, not MTV, John, but his buddies who detonate 5.5 million pounds of high explosives in this state every day, except maybe Christmas and Sundays, his buddies are poisoning babies in the womb. And of course, Senator Manchin is very much pro-life. He believes in the sacredness of the little fetuses.
Right.
But he can't be bothered to acknowledge the science that says his buddies who are blowing up mountains are poisoning babies in the womb, are helping to foster clusters of cancer, are possibly responsible for the excess deaths statistically of 4,000 people a year in mountaintop removal communities. Joe Manchin can't be bothered with that, but he's real mad at the MTV.
Yeah, but listening to people like that talk about being pro-life is like listening to Nazis talking about being pro-Germany. You know, it's okay, great. You're pro one cause at the expense of so many others. So it doesn't, you know, it's, and as far as, yeah, it's like, who cares about MTV? Who cares about that? That's the thing, is that I don't want to generalize too much because I realize there are a lot of smart people in the society. But as far as like the media, it's all focused on superficial, just junk. And it's kind of like that. What's that, you know, they put stuff on the news, they put stuff in the media that'll get people's attention. It doesn't necessarily have to have any real information in it. So the fact that he's like getting all, and that's what these Congress people do. That's what these politicians do. They get all peeved off because, you know, a chicken crossed the road and it didn't do it exactly the way that was, you know, up to regulations.
Right. And like I said, I just go back to those console executives after this man drowned in this lake of toxic waste. I think about the executive, and I just want to ask, you know, when you came home that day, did you look at your family and say, there's a guy at the bottom of the toxic waste pit that we created for our own profit? What do you say we fast for 24 hours, or let's not have dinner tonight, or let's go and visit? No, none of that.
No.
It's just the cost of doing business.
Oh, yeah, that's their favorite line. It's like, we support, they always do that. They're like, we support capitalism. And that's it. We support capitalism and we're so sorry. It's just, we support capitalism. And if you don't agree with this, then you must not. It's this blanket sort of like.
But there's stuff that goes with it, John, that's past capitalism. If you don't support that, you don't support capitalism. If you don't support capitalism, you're a communist. If you're a communist, you must hate Jesus.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course, they try to make it, of course, that's like these people who are like, if you don't support us being bigoted against other people, you must not like our religion. Like, that, it's, and they do that all the time. The last time we spoke, you were bringing up the whole, the fact that Republicans only have, like, one demographic left. And the only demographic they really have are the people that fought the civil rights movement and want women to stop voting. That's it. That's all they've got, and it's like, as those people get older and older, they're probably in their 70s now, all the Republicans have left is, okay, let's steal the election, or let's own the machines that you know, they used to vote. That's all they've got. So, I don't know, I mean, I'm kind of getting a little bit tangential here, but does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I don't think it's tangential at all, because somehow or another, at some time or another, all of this just comes together.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's kind of freaky because it's like what the media does is they separate everything. You know, they compartmentalize everything. They say, you know, this isn't really related to that, except it might be as long as it benefits us. You know, as long as the story and the connected stories benefit basically the 1%, then they'll present it to you. But if it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't benefit them, they're not going to present it to you. It's like during the BP disaster over in the Gulf of Mexico. They were basically doing all these stories about how people were going out and protesting, but they weren't saying anything about the fact that basically a British company was telling Americans where they could go on American soil. They didn't do one story on that because it didn't support the 1%.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty telling, but if you just watch with maybe one just needs to become a little bit jaded.
Okay.
But there's an undercurrent of slime that just runs underneath all of this capital driven, all of this profit driven madness.
Yeah, well, I don't think you have to be jaded. I think you just have to be a realist. I mean, I think once you realize that the people that operate and present the news are part of the 1%, then you also realize why they aren't, you know, giving you any real information. It's because it's not necessarily because they don't want you to have it. It's because it doesn't benefit them. That kind of information doesn't benefit their paychecks.
Right, and it goes back to what we have been arguing for way over a year now, that little four-letter bumper sticker phrase, they want it all.
Right.
And I don't know, for some people maybe it's easier to comprehend than others.
Okay.
But we're not kidding. You know, all means all.
Well, have you heard of the book War is a Racket by Smedley Butler?
Oh, sure, yeah, I've read it.
I mean, how prophetic was that? It's 2012, and you've got, what is it, I don't know if it's KBR or who's over there now, but you got contractors over in these countries, you know, making hand over fist, doing jobs that the military used to do, but they can't do now because, you know, some politician wants their business buddy to get a contract.
Right, because war is good business. And for those of us who come from the class that provides the meat targets for war, it's terrifying. And for anybody who has a loved one who goes over there, it is life spent on tenterhooks until they come home, if they come home.
Yeah.
But for another class who has no skin in the game, so to speak, and it's no game, and it ain't just skin. War is good business. And again, that's terribly hard to just really bring inside yourself and fully comprehend. But it is just like if a bulldozer operator drowns in toxic waste. Ultimately, Consol will have a very good year, and whatever they pay out to the widow of that dozer operator, well, you know, they'll write that off on their taxes as cost of doing business.
All right. I mean, can you imagine how quickly that business would stop if the Bush twins worked there? Or how quickly the wars would stop if the Romney kids were in it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine? I thought it was hilarious listening to Mitt Romney talk about how what did he say? He said a mission was equivalent to a tour of duty for a soldier. Like, what? Really? Seriously? Like a mission going over and asking people to join your religion is somehow equated to going through boot camp and then doing a tour? Really?
Yeah.
So, I can't, it's almost... It's like you brought up Barbara Bush, you know, and her whole attitude about Katrina too, and it's the same sort of apathy. It's like she's like, oh, you know, they should be fine. They're great, you know, hanging out in the stadium while their homes are ruined by Katrina.
Yeah, we're just afraid they're gonna like. We're just afraid that they're gonna like Houston so much they won't ever want to leave.
Right. I mean, and do you think, like, how much of that do you think is is sort of like her trying to get over her own guilt, and how much do you think is just pure apathy?
No, it's not apathy.
Okay.
It's open hostility.
Okay.
I mean, Barbara Bush despises the little people.
Okay.
Remember, you said you're young. I don't know how young. But I remember when George H.W. Bush, you know, Pappy Bush, was
right.
being nominated to run for the presidency in 1988.
Right.
And they did an interview with Barbara sitting there in the audience.
Right.
And seated next to her was Jebby, and I think George was there. But
okay.
Jebby was there with his wife and their children. And she and because Jebby had, I can imagine the screaming at Kenny Bunkport when this went down. Jebby married a Latina woman, Mexican,
okay.
and had children by her. Jebby even converted to Catholicism over her. And so, in this interview at the Republican National Convention in 1988, she said, "Yes, I'm here, and here's my son Jeb, and that's my son George, and down there, those are Jeb's children. We call them the little brown ones."
Oh my! This is like the sociological equivalent of McCain having the adopted baby, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Remember, the George W. Bush campaign sleazed and slimed him with a direct mail campaign in South Carolina, saying, "Did you know that John McCain has a Negro baby?"
Right. And how many stories do they have like that where like Strom Thurmond's all like, "Oh, you know, we don't like these people and these people," and it turns out he had a love child.
Oh yeah.
it's amazing. And then you know what I thought was funny as far as this sort of racially motivated stuff that the Republicans do is the whole Michael Steele thing. It's like they got this stereotype of black people, African Americans, you know, and they're like, "Oh, this is how they talk. We found one guy that talks the same way and he puts on a suit. And therefore he's qualified." You know, like Sarah Palin. "Oh, we found a woman, you know, she looks nice, she looks presentable, she's not too bright, but we'll use her because they pick Hillary Clinton." It's like the most superficial choices.
Well, and now we see the same thing under in operation here, and I got to go real quick, but consider Jim DeMented of South Carolina stepping down midterm to go run the Heritage Foundation, and lo and behold, they were ready Johnny on the spot with a Republican man of color that is being argued as the person who should be elevated to elevated into his seat.
Okay.
It's the most
yeah.
cynical kind of politics. They're desperate after the ass whipping of the lily white Republican Party. They're desperate to find some means of saying, "See, some of our best friends are black."
Right, exactly. That's exactly it. That's exactly what they do.
Yep. Yeah. Well, John, I've got to roll out of here, but thanks for the call and thanks for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Bob. You're totally excellent. Keep being awesome. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Tell your friends and neighbors.
I will.
All right. Bye now. That's our new buddy, John. It is time to get out of here. This is one that has certainly flown by. Thanks to everybody who helped out with raising not just this evening's funds, but with catching up a little bit to where we ought to be. Thank you immensely. Normal, to the extent that it's more than a setting on a dryer, normal broadcast week ahead with the exception of Friday when I'll be on the road. I'm looking forward to tomorrow. I hope you are as well. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Lottie and Sparky in the chat room. Sparky's also the moderator of the Horn Malloy Skype chat on Friday nights. I haven't been there in a while. I got to figure out a way to... Well, I can't do it this Friday either. Darn. But I'll get there. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to the lovely Agnes for her help with the posts. Thanks to John Fox. Hope you're doing okay, John. John had a vehicular... some vehicular nastiness that he can tell you about if he wishes. He's okay, he says, but still, that kind of stuff messes with your world. Hope you're doing better, John Fox. And thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW. ACHECT.net and ACHECT, A-C-H-E-A-C-T, ACHECT.org. Go there and learn how you can be a part of ending Appalachia's agony by supporting and pushing forward the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is coming up next on The Horn.